Now we got too excited for the laugh. Is it recording now?
Mr. President, this is for the North American Newspaper Alliance article. Will you please just let yourself speak freely here on what you feel has come of the Khrushchev visit here, recalling, Mr. President, that you had recommended that Khrushchev be invited here, but of course your recommendation was he be invited here in order to show the American people what this man stands for.
I think that he's very effectively shown what he stands for. He's talked very frankly. He's shown that he's used to dictatorship and can't stand criticism, and that his idea of going across the country, of course, was to see what we had and whether he could make statements detrimental to our plan of operation. He couldn't, although he tried his best. I am hoping that his final meeting with the president at Shangri-La will be of benefit to the country. And if it is, maybe we can postpone any approach to a third world war, and that's what we're all interested in.
Do you feel that it was worth the risk we took?
Yes, I do. I do. I think it was all right to invite him over here, let him take a look at things. And the only thing I'm sorry about is the president didn't go along with him and point these things out to him. He had a very good mentor in Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr. But I think if the president had been in a position where he could have gone with him, it would have made a much more impressive trip, because the president then could have spoken for the country while Khrushchev was speaking for the communists.
That's a very interesting view. Now, were there any risks involved in having him over here?
The most serious risk, of course, was that something might happen to him physically, because the refugees from those countries that have been persecuted by the Russians are in great numbers over here, and I was always very much worried that something might happen to Khrushchev, over which we had no control, and that we'd get the blame for it. But I'm as happy as I can be that he's safely at home.
Well, Mr. President, what do you think was achieved at Shangri-La? What do you think was achieved from what you read from the last communique issued?
Well, the best conclusion that I can come to is that there was a lot of discussion and no final decision on anything. But I hope eventually that decision can be made. Khrushchev still stuck to his idea of no united Germany and no free Berlin if he could help it. And there we are, right where we were when we started. But then conversations like that never do any harm, because we find out what the other fellow's thinking about, and maybe we can come to a point where we can negotiate. I don't think we've reached that point yet.
Do you think there's any reason for the president to have postponed his trip until the spring? You were opposed to his going to Moscow.
Well, I've always been very much afraid that something might happen to the president while he was in Russia. And of course, the weather in Russia, beginning now, is very, very severe. And the president's been suffering from some difficulties. He has a cold now and is going down south to have it cured, and I hope it works out all right. It'd be much better, I think, if he feels that he has to go to Russia, to go when the weather's much better than it is now.
But you felt that in a way it would involve the prestige of the office to go there before any agreement was reached.
I think that's correct. I still feel that way, but then the president is the man who makes the foreign policy of the country. And if he decides that he ought to go, there's no reason why he should be stopped. Although I sincerely hope that nothing will happen that will anyway jeopardize our standing with the free world.
You were for Khrushchev's visit to the United States many months ago. You urged it as a proper step in the direction of dealing with the Russians. Why were you advocating a visit by Khrushchev to the United States?
Because no Russian dictator had ever seen this country as it is. The only ideas that they had formed of the United States and the free world was what they had seen in their own papers, in their own propaganda. And of course, when a man sees things on the ground as they are, he gets a different viewpoint. And I was sincerely hoping that Khrushchev would get a different viewpoint. I don't know whether he has or not.
Do you think that you can now take seriously their representations about any negotiations they wish to conduct?
Well, if I made an agreement with them, I'd want to have the force to make it work, because unless the force is behind an agreement, they pay no attention to it. Look at Czechoslovakia and Poland and Romania and all the rest of those countries that they agreed to allow free elections and free government. Look what they are now. They have slave governments to the Russians.
Now, Stevenson says in an article in the Times this morning, by the way, it's for the New York Times and not for the North American newspaper line.
Understand.
Stevenson says that it's a good thing to continue the talks, but he doubts that in the long run that Khrushchev will agree to the type of controls that we would think necessary to control disarmament.
So I think that's absolutely true, because we made them an offer when we had a monopoly on the atomic energy program to put the control of that great force under the direction of the United Nations, with inspections in every country. And the Russians vetoed it 265 or 67 times. I forget how many it was.
Why?
I think they have the same idea on this other thing.
Well, what do you think of their disarmament proposal as
well? Well, we made that disarmament proposal in 1927 in conjunction with the then ambassador from Russia, Litvinov. It never came to anything, and I am hoping that this one will, but I have my doubts.
Is it 27 or 37?
27.
Litvinov was not ambassador to us then. We had not recognized Russia until 33.
Well, Litvinov made the proposition.
In Geneva.
In Geneva, that's right.
That's right.
The League of Nations. He made it to the League of Nations.
League of Nations at Geneva.
That's right.
And what was our reaction to it?
We were in favor of it, but we never got anywhere with it, for the simple reason that we were remembering the disarmament conference in the early 1920s, when we agreed to naval limitation and sank all our navies, and then the rest of them went ahead and built stronger navies, and we came out in the World War II, if I remember correctly, as a result of that.
Well, Mr.
Charles Evans Hughes was the Secretary of State when that negotiation was made.
Well, Mr. President, do you think that as a result of this visit, the so-called Cold War can begin to ease off?
I hope so, but I have my doubts. I don't think that the Cold War has been carried on by the United States of America. The Cold War has come from east of the east boundary of East Germany. That's where it's come from. And that's Russia, if you understand what I mean.
Do you think we are a match for their present propaganda peace drive?
Well, they've always been crying peace and democracy, and neither word means anything in Russian in the manner in which we translate it. When they talk about peace, they mean conquest of the countries that they want to take over. And that's exactly what they mean by disarmament. They mean disarmament of their people on the other side of the line, but themselves to keep arms so they can take advantage of that situation.
Well, Mr. President, Khrushchev says that he's now going to Peiping. We'll have news about that very shortly. I understand that during the discussions at Shangri-La, when the President and Khrushchev began to discuss the Far Eastern situation, they were so hopelessly divided that Eisenhower abandoned any discussion of it. Don't you think the Far East and the Pacific also play a very important role in this whole Cold War?
There isn't a doubt about it, and I think one of the reasons of Khrushchev's visit over here is because he's afraid of the yellow peril at his back. And that's one thing the Kaiser was always talking about, was the yellow peril. And I think the Russians have it now. They developed it themselves. It's a Frankenstein, and they're worried about it.
There is a, he made a big to-do in many places about feudalism preceding capitalism, and capitalism giving way to communism, and that communism would eventually take over the whole business, that it was one of the inevitables of the Russian.
If we had communism, there might be something to that, but there isn't any communism in Russia. It's a totalitarian state, just the same as Hitler and Franco and all the rest of these dictators. Mussolini was another one. And the Russians don't have communism, they only have a dictatorship. You read about communism in the Acts of the Apostles, and you find exactly what it means.
But you feel, however, if as long as conversations go on, if the Russians will keep on talking rather than acting, that's a good thing.
Of course it is, and maybe we can then reach the Russian people, and they'll have the same reaction that the French people did after Louis XIV. Of course, it took the reign of two kings to get to the French Revolution. And our own revolution was only a re-implementation of the freedom of the English people. We were trying to get it on this continent, and George III wouldn't let us. And I saw the other day where some English woman had said the British always won, and they said they won the American Revolution, that we fought against a German king, George III, and we fought against Hessian troops that came from Germany, and therefore the English won that American Revolution. And I think that's true.
Well, now, Mr. President, I'd just like to read a little bit here from William B. Shannon, the Washington correspondent, the New York Evening Post, who starts off by saying, Nikita Khrushchev, the best natural politician to hit town since Harry Truman left, returned to Washington glowing with triumph. And he says, why shouldn't he glow with triumph? The truth behind the cliches was that Khrushchev has paid nothing for gains in propaganda, prestige, and respectability he has reaped from his journey through America. Now, the question has been raised, hasn't Khrushchev, in a way, had a certain situation in Russia by which this trip would be helpful to him?
There isn't any question about that, and that's the reason he made the trip. And that's the reason I say it would have been a wonderful thing if the president had gone along with him and not have allowed him to take the headlines. The president ought to have those headlines.
Well, Mr. President, he then goes on to say, after a weekend devoted to serious conversation, Khrushchev had graciously consented only to keep the dialogue going about Berlin. He did not withdraw his request for separate peace treaties with East Germany and West Germany. What about that?
He's wrong. Germany ought to be reunited. And it ought to be reunited as it was agreed to at Potsdam and Yalta.
And he did not guarantee Western rights in Western Berlin.
Of course, he wouldn't guarantee Western rights anywhere if he can help us. And all we can do is to maintain those rights as we did with the Berlin airlift.
He did not even cancel his threat to abrogate those rights by force, although a statement he made was, the statement both made was, that all disputes should be settled by amicable discussion and not by force, but it's not what the United Nations is for.
That's what the United Nations is for, of course. And when he said they ought to be settled by conversations and not by force, he means they ought to be settled in favor of the Russians and not on a fair basis.
In other words, his open-end ultimatum remains in effect, says Shannon. He has merely condescended to continue talking, and he goes back to Russia a bigger man than he came. Was ever prestige acquired so easily? Was ever a political triumph gained so cheaply? Is there any wonder there was a smile on the face of Nikita? This, Mr. President, is from the New York Evening Post, which has been very
anti-Truman.
I understand. The reason they're anti-Truman is because I told them where to get off. They're among these synthetic liberals that we read about, and they don't mean a word that they say. So it shows that they'll play both sides against the middle whenever they get a chance. I don't believe that Khrushchev really means a word he says, and I wouldn't trust him across the street. But then it's up to the government to do that. I don't have anything to do with it. I'm just a retired farmer from Missouri.
Do you see any significance in the way that the business and industrial and financial community has been gone out of its way to be kind to Khrushchev, and how labor had been so vigorous in its opposition and in its confrontation of him with the basic facts of our
democracy?
Yes,
these great industrialists have always had a notion that they could trade with Russia and make a lot of money. I think that the labor people, those who have been to Russia, and a great many of them have discovered that the Russians really have no labor government. They have a totalitarian state which oppresses labor just as it was oppressed in the past in other countries. And the industrialists all have a notion that they can sell a lot of things to Russia. Well, they might deliver a lot of things to Russia, but I'd like to see them get paid for them.
I only want to get your thoughts on why Russia is a self-perpetuating kind of dictatorship without ever seriously running into trouble with its people, although it's an obvious dictatorship.
I can't understand that, because every single successor, that is Lenin, Stalin, Khrushchev, have obtained the positions by murder and what they call one of these purges. And each one of them, succeeding Lenin, has climbed on the coattails of the man ahead of him by murder and slave labor camps. And that's not the proper way for a government successor to obtain power. In our country, we elect a president every 4 years. And you'll find, even in the South American countries where the dictators have been run out, they've had great bloodshed and trouble in getting rid of them. And the successor then is in the same position that his predecessor was if he's a dictator. And dictator governments can't have a succession that's calm and peaceful.
Mr. President, Khrushchev said that the president works under greater difficulty than he does because there are certain ruling circles in this country who are making it difficult for him to act as a man of peace. What do you think of that?
It's not the ruling people underneath the president. It's the people of the United States who always have a hand in the government of the United States. They can throw out any man in office whenever they feel like it, when an election comes along. They can't do that in Russia. The only way they can throw people out in Russia is to murder them.
Well, Mr. President, when President Eisenhower yesterday held a press conference, he slipped up on Berlin in that he said that the Berlin situation was abnormal and that he didn't know of any solution which could guarantee West Berlin. That compelled Haggerty immediately to rush in with a written clarification. Now, this not only happened with the president, but I'm told this morning that the Germans are also upset because Hertha had made some statement to the effect about the problem of signing a treaty with East Germany, and they're disturbed now that signing if we agree to this policy of signing separate treaties between West and East Germany, that we're abandoning something fundamental.
That's true, we would be. The Berlin Airlift is the best answer to that. That is an agreement made with the people who were in control of Russia at that time, and it ought to be maintained, and Germany ought to be reunited on the basis on which that treaty between at Yalta and Potsdam was made.
Do you think that the Khrushchev visit succeeded in getting the president and some of our leaders to a softer attitude about Russia and maybe made them susceptible to a compromise on Russian terms?
No. Well, I don't know. But there shouldn't be any compromise on Russian terms. Those terms ought to be ours, because the Russians have broke the agreements that they made with us, and we ought to make them keep them.
Would you have instructed the American people and suggested to the American press to be kind to Khrushchev during a visit had you been president?
Of course I would. Courtesy is the easiest thing in the world to display. And when a man is a visitor with another country, he ought to be treated courteously, and I've said that all along.
Now, Mr. President, I want to quote from the New York Daily News and Ted Lewis, who I know personally is a Democrat, so that's making a difference, but I just want to give him background.
Right, go ahead.
He says, "The glum and stricken look tonight on the faces of White House and State Department officials was clear evidence, if any further proof were needed, that they had been taken for suckers in a slick con game operated by Nikita Khrushchev. The harsh fact on this climactic day of Khrushchev's visit that President Eisenhower's first try at personal diplomacy to ease Cold War tensions had reached a dead end." The bitter, well, what about this, about the personal diplomacy?
Well, the only man in the history of the country that I remember who's had the best of luck in that sort of diplomacy was Franklin D. Roosevelt, and he's dead. I wish he were alive.
All the soft soap that came from Khrushchev's phony answers to questions, says Lewis, or from the peculiar communique winding up the futile Camp David talks with Ike can be treated as so much fraud. What is important is that Ike has called off his scheduled visit to Moscow later this fall, and that diplomats here are convinced that his goodwill trip is now out of the window for good. Of course, as a face-saving technique, it was announced only that the trip would be delayed until next spring. This postponement, actually a cancellation, means that Ike has clearly found that any easing of the Cold War through a personal get-together with Khrushchev has failed. The customary lower-level talks will now be resumed in the always necessary effort to keep a diplomatic exchange going between East and West to prevent a nuclear war catastrophe.
I think that's true, and I'm very happy that that postponement was made because of the weather and everything else that enters into this thing, but I am sincerely hoping that it's a permanent postponement.
And you hope that during this period we can get evidence that Khrushchev really means when he says he wants to end the Cold War.
That's exactly right, and I think you'll find he doesn't want to end it. He wants to prolong it in his favor. That's what he came over here for.
Now, what signs or signposts are we to look for that they are beginning to carry out some policy of abandoning their provocative ways?
I haven't seen any as yet.
What signs should we look for? What could be?
Well, all they have to do is to keep the agreements that they made with President Roosevelt and myself, and then we know that they mean what they say.
Well, with respect to the Middle East, East
That's
Germany,
right.
and other places,
That's
now
right.
what should they be doing there that they're
well,
not now doing?
They'll have free elections in Poland and Romania and Bulgaria and Czechoslovakia and Hungary, as was agreed on, and then they ought to agree to the consolidation of East and West Germany on the basis which was agreed on when the war stopped.
How about the Middle East?
In the Middle East, they've stirred up trouble in the Middle East, but our friends in the Middle East should be supported. And I want to say to you that if the Mediterranean fleet had been moved at the right time, there wouldn't have been any trouble over Suez Canal.
Well, let me ask you this, Mr. President. They have both have pushed up the disarmament question now to a major position. I suppose one of the signs that Russia really wanted to do something about it was to agree to some stages of control of any disarmament. Most of the UN people that I've talked to regard the disarmament proposals of Khrushchev as just phony propaganda stuff. But where he said in his last broadcast before he left that, of course, he's in favor of control stage by stage, don't you think that that would be a very important step to
indicate? Isn't there a question about that? If they'd agreed to controls in the beginning, we'd have had disarmament a long time ago.
Just one casual observation. I asked a Japanese gardener what he thought of Khrushchev's visit in a casual way before he could arm himself. And his answer was very simple. He said, "Too much power in one man."
He's absolutely correct.
Oh,
he's absolutely correct. You see, we have a balance of power here in this country. They don't have any balance of power in Russia. It's all one man. And whatever he says has to go. If somebody doesn't agree with him, he goes to a labor camp.
Well, now, Mr. President, he is, Khrushchev is leaving today for Beijing. Red China is now celebrating the 10th anniversary of the triumph of this communistic government taking over power. The president of Red China issued a statement or made a speech yesterday in which he said, Formosa and all the other claims of the Chinese must be met and will never be abandoned. Well, isn't that a continuation of the Cold War?
Not entirely. It's just the same as East Germany and Berlin. Only it's on the Chinese end of the continent.
Now, this may not fit into the thing, but some time ago, the president took a position that if war came to Western Europe, or anywhere in Europe, but we would be in no position to defend it. And from there on, it became evident that our allies began to reassess their position, and they began to weaken as a result of that weak position. And do you think that there is a difference now among our allies that the Russians are exploiting in connection with this drive?
I don't think there's any doubt about that, because the NATO treaty was set up for a solid front against the communists. And if we abandon that, then we are on the road to a third world war, and that's what I don't want to see.
Have you any suggestion, Mr. President, in this critical time in which everybody's talking peace, what are we going to do about it?
Well, we've got to be in a position through the United Nations to enforce peace. And somebody has to have the wherewith to enforce it. United Nations would have been abandoned if we had not been in a position to prevent the communists from taking the Republic of Korea in entirety. We should have had the whole of Korea if the program had been carried through as was intended in the first place.
Would you favor a separate force or police force to be built up by the United Nations eventually to police the quarrelsome areas?
Yes, I would. I've always been in favor of that.
Well, as a final question, do you think we're being maneuvered into a position of grave danger to us?
I don't think there's any doubt about it, and that's always been the idea of the Russians, to maneuver us into a position where we'd fall out with our allies, and then they'd take them one at a time, and that's what NATO was set up to prevent.
All right, Mr. President, we'll hold on this, and then we'll go to work.
Thank you. Thank you.